So tonight I want to continue with this series I started last week on the notes, the Four Noble Truths. If you missed last week's the Dharma talk I gave last week, like all the talks in this series are going to be recorded and they're on my website. So you can always, if you want to catch up, you can find what I said last week about the First Noble Truth. Basically, I'm going to review it, what I said in an hour in about 1 minute here, and then go on to the second noble truth. And basically, the first noble truth is basically just says that life as we live it, as is what the Buddha would call uninstructed worldlings. I love that phrase. Is unsatisfactory. It just doesn't work. There is not we because we're faced with the fact that we're going to get old, we're going to get sick, and we're going to die, or that there is built into our life in the world this unsatisfactory understanding that things are going to change and not change. We're going to slowly but surely change, not for the better. And this is sort of like the existential worry that we all have. And this is what made the Buddha start to practice and then eventually came to his realization. And I'm not saying that life is bad or horrible. There's lots of wonderful things in life, absolutely. But in the end, the way we live our lives in the world doesn't work. It's unsatisfactory. Basically, this whole practice is about seeing things as they really are, or as I was saying last week, I've been changing that to seeing how things as they have come to be, because this is always, we're always in process. Things are always changing, they're never the same. And so if that's the truth, then the obvious question is, why? Why is everything so unsatisfactory? And that's what the second noble truth is about. And so in the sutta, it says someone who is contemplating this, that he knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. So why does dukkha arise? Why do we keep ending up in this unsatisfactory place? And basically the cause of dukkha in the second noble truth, it's very brief, and he says basically that the cause of dukkha is tanha. Tanha is another Pali word typically translated as grasping or craving. You will see it in some translations translated as desire. I think this is an incorrect translation. I mean, because desire is basically neutral. You had a desire to come here tonight to sit and listen to this Dharma talk. This is a wholesome desire. Nothing wrong with it. So it's not, desire in and of itself is a neutral mental formation. But the basically grasping has a note of desperation. Like, I have to have it, or I have to have it right away. I want it right now. Other translations of tanha, I've seen that some people like thirst, not just in the physical sense of drinking. You're thirsting for something, you want something, or unsatisfied longing, even. Like we want something and it isn't, we're not getting it. And the reason this grasping is so critical is that grasping leads to what's called clinging. I want to explain this, and there's a famous teaching that's unique to the Buddha called the 12 steps of codependent arising. And basically, codependent arising means if, and this is in philosophical language terms, if A happens, then B must happen. And if B has happened, then A must have happened. So it's codependent. It works in both directions. And in the teachings on codependent arising, the central teachings of it, I won't go into all of the fine details, but basically something arises at one of the sense doors, which we talked about last time. That's what all is ever happening. Stuff's arising at the sense doors, right? That's one of the steps of codependent arising. Then once something's arisen, something called Vedana, which I'll speak more about some other time, but Vedana basically, it roughly translates as feeling tone. So basically, once something arises at one of the sense doors, this mental formation, purely mental formation called Vedana arises. And Vedana has three forms: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. So it's we experience something, and immediately, at some very quick, just like that, snap of your fingers level, at a mental level, we classify what's arisen as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. This is just it's an automatic function of the mind. We don't do this consciously; it just happens. And then we react to that Vedana by craving. So if something arises that's pleasant, the craving revolves around, I want more of that. I like that. I want to keep that. I want to keep it. I want to make it permanent. Whoops, there I'm in trouble because everything's impermanent. Or I just want more. I want it more often. And if it's unpleasant, then we want to push it away. Oh, no, don't want that. So we crave to get rid of it. If it's neutral, interestingly enough, what typically happens is we go, oh, boring, and we go looking for something more exciting with a bigger hook. Something that's either pleasant or unpleasant. And so no matter what are those forms that Vedana arises, we fall into grasping if we're not mindful. Ah, there's the key, of course. If we're mindful when that Vedana arises and we just go, oh, there's a unpleasant arising, or a pleasant arising has just occurred, then it's just now we're just seeing things as they really are. What's arisen, what has just come to be. But if we don't, if we fall into craving, which is typically what we do in our normal reactive mind, then craving turns into what's called clinging. With clinging, it's sort of like I'm gonna hold on to it really tight. I'm really, not only do I want it, I'm gonna really grab it and hold on to it really tight. And here's the interesting thing about clinging. You'd think clinging was only about things that we like, right? I would cling to something because it was so pleasant. But actually, to push something away, which is what we normally do when we react to something that's unpleasant, we can't push something away if we don't get a really firm grip on it. So that we have to like grab it so I can pitch it. But if I don't have a firm grip on it, I can't push it away. So no, either pleasant or unpleasant, if we fall into craving, we then fall into clinging. Clinging then leads to the other steps in the process, which basically say leads to suffering, leads to unpleasant results. Because we're clinging, we're trying to make something permanent that by its very nature is impermanent, is always changing all the time. It's because that's the nature of everything. But we're caught in this grip of wanting that to be a certain way. So that's the idea behind this second noble truth. We always end up, if we're not very careful and mindful, we end up clinging to things all the time. So it's really useful to think, well, what is it that we actually cling to? And that's the basis of most of my talk has to do with that. And there are classically there are four layers, four kinds of things that we cling to. The first of these is the obvious one, sense pleasures, either pleasant ones or unpleasant ones. Pleasant ones we want more, unpleasant ones don't want that, right? And we cling to them because we keep thinking that somehow or other, that sense pleasure I just had, if I just get another one and another one and another one, if I can just get my next hit of pleasure, then somehow that one will make me happy. Or if I can arrange my life, which is what we all try and do, if I can arrange my life so that I only ever have pleasant things happen and have never have any unpleasant things happen, then I'll be happy all the time. So we start sort of like clinging to and organizing our lives around only pleasant things happening, which, as we all know, doesn't work because life is full of pleasant and unpleasant stuff. It just that's the nature of the world. In Taoism, they talk about the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, like the vast variety of things that are pleasant and unpleasant. But it's like we keep thinking that somehow, no, the next one, that next hit of sweet stuff, that's the one. If I can just figure out what it is and get it, then I'll be happy. But it just doesn't work. Because even if we want to keep that pleasant thing, it's going to change and go away. The fact of impermanence makes this idea of how we're going to be happy nonsense, because we think we can hold on to these things, and they always change. They always change without fail. And this is just what we do. This is Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. He's talking about this, and he has this great story I love to share because it sort of points to how we get caught in this loop. There's a story about the Mullah Nasruddin, a famous Sufi teaching figure. One day he went to the marketplace and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little later, his disciples came and saw the Mullah with tears streaming down his face and mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, Mullah, why do you go on eating them?" As he reached for another one, Nasruddin said, "I keep waiting for a sweet one." This is what we do. We keep waiting for the sweet one that's going to be the perfect thing. And we just keep burning ourselves in the process. It's a great image. I love the image. So that's the first thing we cling to. This idea that sensory pleasures are what's going to make us happy, and also getting rid of the sensory things we don't like. Those two together form the most obvious form of clinging. But there's lots of other things we cling to that are, and the thing about this first layer is these things are pretty easy to notice. We often, being mindful, we can see, oh yeah, here I am caught thinking that somehow or other that Häagen-Dazs ice cream I'm about to eat or just ate is going to make me happy. And well, sure, while I'm eating the Häagen-Dazs ice cream, it's really good, but then it's gone. And then I, as they say, a moment on the lips and a lifetime on the hips has also happened, probably, right? So it's like we're just setting ourselves up over and over again. Anyhow. But the second thing we cling to, views and opinions. So this is more subtle mental stuff. And the thing about views and opinions, first of all, these are partly intellectual things we figured out as we went along by, studying or reading or discussing things with people, whatever. So it's an intellectual process. We come up with a certain set of views of how things are, right? And partly it's cultural, how we grew up. As we grew up, we were taught certain things to be the way things are. That's how it was. I grew up in a very proper Protestant, English Protestant family. And I had a granny who I had this, she was the sweetest lady in the world. She'd feed everybody. But she was like, if someone did something wrong, her answer to that was, well, you know what, they're a Catholic. Right? This was just a view and opinion she had that all Catholics were bound to be not so together, just like those Catholic people. And that was just how she grew up. That was part of her culture. She was a Grand Mistress of the Orange Lodge of Canada, which is like the ultra Protestant world of Canadian church going. That was what she was. Sweet, wonderful lady, but that was her view and opinion of how things were. But we all have things like that deeply embedded in us that we don't even notice most of the time. Because often it's like we see something and in the mind, some thoughts arise along the lines of, well, of course it's that way. Or it's always been that way. Or everybody knows that's the correct way. That's just views and opinions arising and rationalizing everything as being what they are. But these views and opinions are just views. That's all they are. They're just views and opinions. They're like deeply seated ideas that we think are true, that are absolute truth. And that somehow, well, everybody knows that. How many times we get caught saying that? And everybody knows that. And you look at the world. Let's look at the world and how views and opinions in our politics, in our religious structures, in all kinds of things, how they cause so much pain and suffering in the world. And by the way, on an individual level, we start to cause a lot of pain and suffering in the world by our own views and opinions. We don't see it often because, well, I know I'm right. That's the way it is. These are the things we have to really look at. Whenever you hear that little voice in your mind going, well, of course it's that way, or I know I'm right, or well, everybody knows that's the way things are. These are warnings in your mind to go, oh, the mindfulness pops in here and says, is that just a view or an opinion? Is that really how things are, or is that just my filtered view of how things are? Because views and opinions are like filters. They're filters on the mind. We see something and it comes through this filter, and that's how we understand it. We're not seeing it as it really is. We're seeing it through these filters of views and opinions. This is a difficult place to work in this practice, but this is a place we have to work to get clearer, being able to see things more clearly. There's a famous quote. I want to give you a famous quote here. This is the third Zen patriarch, who is well known for famous quotes about all kinds of bits of Buddhist teaching. But this is one of my favorites. He's talking with this. He says, do not seek the truth, only seek to cherish opinions. Do not seek the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Because that's what we do. We don't just cling to them, we cherish them. I'm one of those wonderful people who grew up this way and did that, and whatever those views and opinions are that color our mind all the time. They're like filters They're like color filters, like we see something and it comes through colored by our views and opinions. We don't ever really see clearly unless we're really mindful. The Dalai Lama has a great thing he says about this. He says, when you start to, you're in the midst of something, especially if it's something that you sort of, you can feel yourself getting a little wound up about. See if you can step back and see that event that's getting you wound, or that speech or whatever it is getting you wound. See if you can see it from like six different angles. He says, look at it from the front and the back and from both sides, from up above and down below. See if you can really see it from all the different points of view that other people might have. And then act if you need to act based on that, not on just that first burst of how I know how things are. It will tend to make us pause a lot of time, and probably talk a lot less in the process, which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Okay, views and opinions. That's the second one. Don't seek the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. So that's the second thing we cling to. The third thing, this is related to the Buddha's time. This is called, in the Buddhist teaching, it's called rites and rituals. And you want to explain a little bit about this. In the time of the Buddha, the predominant culture at the time of the Buddha in North India was the Brahmanic culture, the Brahmins, who were the priestly caste, the upper top level castes, were basically controlled everything. And they basically had a rite and a ritual for everything. You want to get some rain, we'll do the we'll get the rains ritual. You want to get married, you want to die, you want to get have someone blessed, doesn't matter what it is. There's a rite and a ritual that covers everything. And of course, you got to go to the Brahmins to get that rite and ritual done. And of course, pay them. That's how they made their living, right? And this was like deeply embedded culture, but put the Brahmins at the top, and then there's these castes and subcastes going down to the untouchables who had no caste at all, who were considered vermin by the Brahmins. And basically, the Buddha said, "Nah, not true." Which in his time, because he came from an upper caste, he was from the warrior caste. He was from an upper caste, and he was a prince originally. People got really upset, but he basically said, "No." And he took untouchables and initiated them into the teachings. He took women, shocking, take women. Oh no, only men can be priests, right? No. He took everybody in and said, "It's okay. You can do this practice too." And spoke very strongly against how these rites and rituals control people's minds and lives. And so this is why this is here in one in the tradition is rites and rituals are things that we cling to because, like, well, that's this is sort of an amplification of, well, that's how things always are, with a nice religious spiritual overlay on top of it, right? But how does this, if that's what, I mean, it's still to a certain extent in India, by the way, that's how things are. It's been illegal. Caste has been illegal since the time of Gandhi back, so it's like 60 years, 70 years now. But it's still very prevalent. And it's also prevalent here in this country. California just passed a law outlawing caste discrimination in the Indian diaspora in California. Which was still, it was a big issue. So it's like this is like this is still going on. But what about our normal, our quote, more normal, our Western culture that we all live in and are part of to one extent or another? How does this apply there? What is it that we cling to there in the terms of rites and rituals? Well, this is where the quote spiritual culture starts to fall down. deeply into trouble, as far as I'm concerned. I was a hippie, right? I grew up in that whole world of, just love everybody and everything's going to be okay. That was like, peace and love, man. Long hair and macrame suspenders on my patched jeans, sort of level, right? And it was like sweet and wonderful, but it totally ignored the fact that half the world, half of the time, things weren't like that. It totally ignored the dark side. And out of that culture came all kinds of very harmful beliefs about how things should be. That took me a while to figure out because I was so much part of it at the time. And, it's endless. Here's one that really I speak out against because it bothers me so much. And that's that someone has something happen to them that isn't very good. Some difficulty arises in their lives. They get sick. They have some big difficulty. And people, these spiritual people, will say, "Well, you must have done something, and this is the result. It's all, it all, everything that's happening to you is your fault. It's all your fault that you have cancer. It's all your fault that XYZ is happening." This is total nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Because stuff just happens. The causes and conditions arise such that things flow into your life and you react to them. But that's just all that's going on. And so to tell people you're responsible for all those things that are happening in your life, that it's your fault that they're happening, is a really harmful, harmful thing to do. But that's very deeply embedded in our Western spiritual culture that we all are associated with at some level. It's the same thing. It's a rite and a ritual in a subtle way, but it's exactly what it is. It's like a little ritual we have about ex it's how we, if we're not careful, explain how some people have horrible things happen to them. It's all their fault. Of course, it's their fault. That they got cancer or they got run over by a truck or who knows what, Stuff just happens, sorry. Here's one last level of what we can't cling to. There's a wonderful sutta that talks about this. You can't even cling to the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. How often do we, if we're not careful, do we think, well, I'm a Buddhist, I'm one of those good people who practice the Dhamma, and we're the ones who've got it all figured out. And that's just clinging to the Dhamma. And in fact, in the Buddha, in one place, more than one place, says at a certain point, when you reach enlightenment, the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, are no longer relevant at all. You just leave them behind. You don't cling to them. You can't cling to them. They're just, skillful means to go towards enlightenment. But clinging to them just causes pain. Just thinking you've got the right answer. Yeah, that's me. So this is just another thing to cling to. Got to be very careful about not clinging even to the Dhamma. Okay. So now we come to the nitty-gritty, so to speak, the fourth level of what we cling to. And that's the sense of a separate self. And this is the one that's the hardest to grasp. To be honest with you, I still struggle with this sometimes myself. But this is where the rubber meets the road, in some senses, in the deeper levels of Buddhist thought. And I want to read a little bit of Joseph Goldstein here again. And the fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to a belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, We get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this great mass of pain. And when I first read that, because this is the first Buddhist book I ever read with this particular book, I was going, yeah, but, you know, this is something that's hard to grasp. Wait, there's no self? You know? And the reason it's so hard is we cling to this sense of self quite powerfully, because without it, who am I? What am I? I mean, these deeply sort of existential questions start to arise. Like, if there's no separate self, no separate Barry out there at all, what's going on? What's left? Okay, a little more Joseph. This is he goes into this a little bit deeper and sort of gives some examples that I think are quite good. This is from his book called Mindfulness. And this is a whole section he has on this idea of what we cling to, this sense of self. And he has a slightly different language. He calls it the craving for becoming. The second kind of craving the Buddha spoke of goes even deeper than the craving for sense pleasures. It's called craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is a very basic urge or desire to be. So, step one. We do this constantly. I was thinking, well, I want another minute of life. I'm clinging to it. I want to be here tomorrow. I want to do X, Y, Z. I want to, you know, finish my college degree. I want to, you know, see my kids grow up. Who knows? But it's all like, I want to be. I want to cling to this sense of existence. This is a very basic urge or desire. Okay. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. Well, that's, of course, I want to be, but I want to have a good time while I'm being, you know. We may or may not believe in rebirth or different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. How often in our daily life do we do that? But also how often while we're sitting in our formal practice, are we thinking, oh, when this is over, what I'm going to have for breakfast. I mean, you know, it could be that simple. Like, you know, you're planning your day while you're sitting there meditating. Actually, what you're doing is having a planning session for what's going to happen that day. This is very normal. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. In a sutta called One Fortunate Attachment, the Buddha gave clear advice for freeing ourselves from this craving, that not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. One who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage, who has one fortunate attachment. We would What would it be like to live with that one fortunate attachment, not reviving the past, not hoping to be in the future? Now, I also have to say something else here, because when I hear this, I've struggled with this for a while, this isn't saying we can't learn from past mistakes. It's quite useful to do that sometimes. But it's when we dwell on those, when we cling to them, when we make our identity around the things I screwed up in the past. The I'm not good thoughts because I did this, I did that, which is always lost in the past, which means you're not in the present moment. And it's not that we shouldn't plan for the future. I mean, we have to, living in the world as householders in particular. If you are a monastic and your every day is the same anyway, you get up, the bell rings, you get up, you sit, you do this, and you go on your begging rounds, and you sit for the rest of practice for the rest of the day, then you don't live so much in the future. But as households, we have to sort of plan for, oh, how am I going to get the money together to pay my mortgage or my rent? Or we have to do that. So we have to live in the world. So I'm not saying you shouldn't plan, but we don't want to cling to those plans. Because often those plans are like, oh, I know, Thanksgiving, I'm going to take a vacation, but I'm going to go someplace warm because it's already getting cold here in Boulder. And I'm going to go someplace warm and just lie on the beach. And we start figuring that out. And then stuff happens along the way, and none of that ever comes true. And we just spent a lot of time thinking about something that, A, wasn't happening in the moment and isn't going to happen at all. Once again, not saying you shouldn't do that. Just be aware that things change all the time because we're living in this world of impermanent things. That if we cling to that future idea, then we suffer. Okay. Continuing on with what Joseph has to say here. On a more momentary level, we can see this craving for becoming in our relationship to the unfolding process itself. Even if we don't have expectations for some big, wonderful experience, how often do we seem to be leaning forward into the next moment, as if somehow the next step, the next breath, the next sensation or thought will resolve everything, complete everything? How often do we do that in our sitting practice? Like looking for that something that's going to happen while I'm sitting, that's going to, like something that happened before or something I want to happen because I read about it in the book and it sure sounded great in the book. Or this teacher told me this story about the stuff that happened to him. I'm to blame for that one. We see this leaning happen when we're feeling something unpleasant and watching for it to change. Or we see it when we're being with some emotion and wanting to feel it more deeply. We're feeling a little sort of sweetness and like, oh no, this is, I gotta make this sweeter still. I want this to be like gushy love feeling. Leaning into it to make, trying to make it happen. The sense of leaning forward, anticipating the next moment, is also a kind of craving for becoming. Here we're not seeing each of these experiences simply as insubstantial, empty phenomena arising and passing in each moment. We're living in a world of wanting. We forget that liberation is not about becoming or getting, not about holding on or craving or clinging, but about letting go and letting be. The great Indian saint Ramana Maharshi put it very simply, try to be less, not more. Great line. Try to be less, not more. So those are the four things we cling to. These are how we create our own suffering and the suffering of those around us. It's how we make our life unsatisfactory over and over and over and over by clinging to these things. Sense pleasures, views and opinions, rites and rituals, and this separate sense of self. And how often do we think about how things used to be? You know, when I was younger and fitter, in my case. Or how it'll be when this is over. Even as like, oh, it's pouring rain, I want to work in my garden. When's the rain going to be over? Well, the rain's going to be over when it's over. Nothing I can do about it. So why are we even thinking about it? And we get caught in that all the time. And often it's something much larger than it's raining right now that we're wanting to be over. And there's a classic Indian teaching story that I really like. It's called the monkey trap story. And this is how they capture monkeys in Southeast Asia. What they do is they take a coconut and they hollow it out and they cut a hole in one end that's just big enough so when the monkey squeezes his hand, he can slip through the hole. And then the other end of the coconut, they drill a hole and attach something firmly to the other end of the coconut. And then they put something really sweet and yummy inside the coconut, something that the monkey will want, right? Monkey comes along, sees there's something in this coconut, reaches his hand in, grabs it, and now that he's made a fist, he can't get his hand out anymore. He's pulling and pulling and pulling, but he won't let go of what's in there. And he gets trapped. It's pretty brilliant understanding monkey psychology in a sense. But this is what we do. We keep sticking our hand in and then wondering why we can't get out of the coconut. This is how we act in the world over and over and over again, like clinging to something because we don't want to let it go. But that's what we need to do. We need to let it go. This is how when we start to see, there I am with my hand in that trap again, clinging, all I have to do is let go. And all the suffering I'm creating for myself is gone. All I did was let go. It wasn't like I had to do some amazing thing. I just had to go from making a fist to opening my hand. Just let go. So suffering, to a certain extent, is a choice. Yeah. We constantly are making choices that cause us to experience more and more unpleasantness, more and more unsatisfactoriness. Over and over and over again, we keep doing that. All we have to do is let go. And but this doesn't mean that we can somehow avoid the physical and emotional downs in life. You know, life has its natural ups and downs, its cycles. So it's not like, oh, if I just let go, then everything's going to be fine all the time. No, you're still going to have stuff happen. Your body's going to age. Your friends are going to change. Things are going to happen. Your car's going to get wrecked by some guy driving by and sideswiping you. Who knows? Stuff is going to happen. We can't avoid that. But we can avoid creating more than what is just flowing along the river of stuff towards us. We can choose. And I think that's the really important message the Buddha brought to the world. Like, these things are a choice. You can cling or you can not cling. So we can't change what's coming towards us. We can't change, you know, we can't avoid these physical and emotional ups and downs. But what we can change is how we react to them. That's really a lot of what the Buddha's teaching is all about, being non-reactive, not being caught up in a reactive process where we end up clinging yet again to something. Just being able to let it, see it for what it is, and let it be, let it go. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that sometimes we have to act in the world, because we're, like I say, we're householders, we live in the world, and sometimes we have to act in the world to correct things that are we see to be improper. This isn't fatalistic in any sense of the world at all. It's just trying to, as best we can, to not just be reactive all the time. Not yet again get caught in a reactive mode, which is what we do when we cling to these four layers of things. As always, I have to have a little bit of poetry to finish. So this is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, and it's quite simply called Being Present. Breathe, relax, and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be, no need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, opens to receive. That sort of sums up how to deal with the second noble truth.